Hey, this is Julia.
Hey, this is Jeremiah.
Welcome to Sex Evangelicals, the podcast about the sex education the church didn't want you to have, hosted by us, two licensed and certified sex therapists.
If you're like us and you grew up in an evangelical, Mormon, or Pentecostal community, what you learned about relationships, sexuality, and gender may have deeply harmed you.
Our podcast is here to help the ex-evangelical and deconstructing communities heal relationally and sexually.
Whatever your story, we all have this in common. We all exist in the context of relationships.
We are covering it all here, from the terrible Christian literature that still activates my eczema, debates about the inherent sinfulness of spaghetti straps, and when honeymoon sex goes terribly wrong, all the way to myths about infidelity, candid conversations about erections, and everything we wish we knew before becoming sex therapists.
So if you're interested in having a flourishing sexual and relational life, especially if you missed the sex education that the church didn't want you to have, welcome to Sex Evangelicals.
Let's keep healing together.
Coming up this season on Two Lives.
I've wasted too many years of my life focusing on what's wrong with me. What I have learned through this is that I am enough. Damn it, I'm good enough.
It was tough to disappoint my mother. It was tough to watch my father feel like he failed. That was hard. So, yeah, I turned my life around in prison.
It actually was very comforting to know I'm not a bad person trying to get good. I was a sick person trying to get well.
All that and more in Season 9 of Two Lives.
Welcome to I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist. And Troy, we've just had a great chat, haven't we, which the listeners are going to hear very soon.
Yeah, that's right. It was a wonderful chat with Arnie Zonneveld, who is the co-founder and now president of Muslims for Progressive Values.
And I tell you, you'll hear this in the interview. We reflect this a few times through it, but fuck me. The similarities between fundamentalist Christianity and progressive Christians and fundamentalist Islam and progressive Muslims is just fascinating. Like it is just, it's almost like if you closed your eyes and didn't speak the words Islam in a lot of the sentences, you go, we're speaking about Christianity.
Oh, totally. And that's why I wanted to do this series, Brian, you know, because it's just so interesting to know that progressives are pushing up against fundamentalists on exactly the same points: the rights of women, the treatment of LGBTQ, political values, education, you know, all these kinds of things that she spoke about. These are the very things that we're doing. She even talked about reproductive rights as well. Was another thing. We didn't dig into that in the chat, but she mentioned it. And so I think as you listen to this, you're going to just be blown away. But the other thing that blew me away, Brian, was how much good work she's really doing.
Yeah, and globally. I mean, based in the States, but certainly the work is global and the influence just seems to be quite huge. She's got quite a profile, obviously, from her music career leading up to that, but this really seems to be her passion, and she's obviously melding the two together. But it's just incredible. I mean, and very intelligent. Arnie was very articulate and intelligent and was able to I felt like I was led into a world which I had very little idea about, and certainly the idea that I have had about it has been led by media and has been obviously shadowed by my Christian experience and what we spoke about and thought about Muslims when we were in the fold.
Yeah, well, it was interesting the way that she talked about the sort of demonized version of Islam, and that's the only version that's basically peddled. And we know within Christianity, there are so many different kinds of Christianity, even within the fundamentalist camp, even within the liberal camp, there's just so many different versions. And so I think in that she really presented to us that there are of course, the moderate Muslims, but there's these progressive Muslims. And again, just the battles are exactly the same. And the things that they're facing on a daily basis and the pushback and everything, exactly the same. And it reminded me of that sort of militant atheist that sort of stands up fundamentalism and, you know, shoots it down. And we agree with them. But it doesn't mean necessarily that everyone has to end up an atheist or that you can't even be a Christian, of course, either. So, yeah, fascinating. And I think there's going to be more of this as we unpack these other different versions or different variations of progressive religiosity. But I think, Brian, unless you've got something to say, I really want to welcome our listeners in and let's open the box and let's have a look at this and see what she has to say because it's a fascinating discussion.
It is, and I think everyone is going to enjoy it. So over to Arnie.
As part of our series on progressive versions of world religions, today we've got Annie Zonneveld, and she's a writer, singer-songwriter, and the founder and president of Muslims for Progressive Values, an international human rights organization that advocates for social justice and equality. She's a strong supporter of freedom of expression and conscience, and also women's rights and LGBTQ rights as well. Born in Malaysia, Arnie is a Muslim since birth. She spent a good portion of her formative years in Germany, Egypt, and India, ready for this, as an ambassador's daughter. Her exposure to different politics, religions, and cultures has shaped her inclusive worldview. She's also, and I'm going to have to talk about this, she's a Grammy-certified award-winning songwriter, and she sees the power of music and the arts in what she does around social justice and progressive Islam. So, Arnie Zonneveld, welcome to I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Arnie, one of the first questions that we ask someone, and we didn't actually send you this question in advance, and I'm sorry we didn't think to do it, but we ask this of people all the time. Were you a teenage fundamentalist?
No, not a fundamentalist in the way in the religious fundamentalism. I was a fundamentalist in the feminist strain, and I realized that when I was 12 years old. And I can share the story. I was doing the call for prayer. I was practicing it privately in my room. And my mother comes running to this room, to my bedroom, and with a horrified look on her face, and she's like, stop. I'm like, what did I do wrong? And she says, you can't do the call for prayer. And I'm like, why? Because you're a girl. And that was a moment I knew, okay, this is so whack. I can't subscribe to this. And obviously I didn't say that to my mom. I would have got a pretty good slap, but I kept it to myself. But that was a moment at 12 years old that I knew that I was not traditional in the way that my mom was grooming me to be.
That's the start of the radical Arnie by the sound of it.
Yes, it was.
We love it. Look, for those like us who are teenage fundamentalists, the view of Islam is something that is very skewed, and it's skewed to in the favour of Christianity, going, Islam is evil. But can you tell us, give us a bit of a brief overview of Islam, and for people who don't know what it's about, sort of step us through, how does it look?
Yeah, I guess that depends on I can give you two different ways, right? I'll give you the traditional look and then I'll give you my look.
I like that.
And so the traditional look is basically you have the five pillars of Islam. That is, the first one is declaration of faith. There's no God but God, and Prophet Muhammad is his messenger. The second one is prayer five times a day, or if you're a Shia, it's three times a day. The third one is fasting. The fourth one is giving to charity, and the fifth one is going to Hajj should you be able to afford to. So that's like the five pillars of Islam. And what's really interesting is we can go into like, is this literal, Ani, or not? We can park that for a minute. But from my perspective, what is completely different or what should have been the pillars of Islam, is basically love and compassion for all, for human dignity, for the environment, as caretakers of this world. So there's a lot of values that are in the Quran that is not stipulated as the pillar, which I would have made the pillars of Islam.
Oh, here we go. That's the radical Ani coming out. And look, what you said, if a Shiite Muslim's only got to pray three times a day, wouldn't everyone opt out to be a Shiite Muslim?
That's what exactly what I was thinking when I was here. I was thinking, okay, I know which one I'd subscribe to.
So that seems a lot easier. Yeah. And so step us through your version of Islam.
So what's really important to also know, and actually most Muslims don't know this, is that the five pillars of Islam is not actually listed in any of the pages of the Quran. It was actually created after Prophet Muhammad died, and the caliphs, the religious leaders after the Prophet died, he said, you know what, we kind of need like sort of a framework that defines us as Muslims, right? But the Quran actually says this is not a new religion. It's a continuation of Judaism and Christianity and the previous books, the previous revelations. But what Muslims wanted to do and needed to do is they needed to institutionalize a spiritual teaching, right? Like all religions. And so the men got together and they decided, it's always the men, they decided like, okay, we're going to have these really strict set of rules that defines that, you know, you're a Muslim. And it also defines whether you're a good Muslim or a bad Muslim. And so that is basically what the five pillars of Islam is. Now, the five pillars of Islam is an extrapolation of the various passages of the Quran that talks about connecting to God, but it doesn't stipulate how you connect to God or to the Creator, right? It stipulates kindness, it stipulates charity multiple of times. It stipulates justice, but justice is not part of the five pillars of Islam. But justice would be one of my pillars of Islam. And that's kind of like the anchor from which I do my work in human rights and social justice.
That's really interesting because I've heard you say a few things that I'm sort of already drawing parallels with our expression of at least Christianity or Christian fundamentalism. And that is that you spoke about the men all got together. That was one thing. And also that you're saying a lot of Muslims don't know this. That's another thing that I think they don't sometimes know their own history or how the religion formed. And another thing is that it sounds like these pillars were almost what we would call in Christianity the creeds, that they draw these things from the Bible, but they're not necessarily found in the Bible. And so, yeah, I thought that was quite interesting. But Ani, I just want to ask you, when you were growing up, was your expression of Islam spiritual, cultural, or a combination of both?
It was a combination. My parents were practicing Muslims, but the difference is that they never forced us to pray, never forced religion down our throats. And so it was really more of, you know, leading by example, and led by example, they did. We fasted as a family, and I found growing up, I liked fasting just because it really made me very disciplined. Which until today is kind of like how I operate. I'm very, very disciplined, and you know, living in Los Angeles, being in the music business at one time, etc., it was a discipline that really came through for me. But the actual, but you know, my dad, you know, he was like you said in my introduction, he was an ambassador, he was a diplomat, so he was very pragmatic, and he was also not dogmatic. I think this is really key. My mother was the one that was more traditional, and I would even dare say more misogynistic, whereas my father was the one who was the feminist and, you know, aim for the stars and, you know, go to school, do well, get a career. You know, it was none of this, you know, you got to get married stuff, right? So it was very, so it was a bit of a whiplash between my dad and my mom. You know, they had very different set of values. My dad was the more educated one and my mother was, you know, small town girl, right? So, and with it, she came with her set of values and how she was raised. And so I think their values were also translated in some ways in a faith narrative. The one thing that my parents both gave me a hard time about was that I needed to think more before I speak. And yeah, they used to disparage me. My dad especially used to disparage me about not thinking enough and use your critical brain and God gave you a brain, so use it, you know, that kind of stuff. So that was really hammered into my head, which now I really adhere to.
It's very much a parallel to quite often what I saw in my world in Christianity, where you'd have more of your fundamentalist conservative versions. And generally they were people that were either brought up in that expression of faith or converted into it, like Troy and I. And then you would have your more social justice aligned version of Christianity, which people felt they had to justify quite often to the fundamentalists because it was seen as a lesser version of Christianity, a softer version, and one where you were cherry picking what you believed. Was that something that you also found in your expression of Islam, that people were saying, oh, you're just making up your version?
Well, I turned that question, I accused the other side, the radicals, the conservatives, that, well, you're cherry picking yourself. So, right? There's ample of cherry picking. I mean, I think at the end of the day, you have a choice. You can cherry pick the good stuff and you can cherry pick the ugly stuff. I choose to cherry pick the love and compassion part. Which dominates the Quran and a lot of the examples of Prophet Muhammad. He was the feminist for his time. Now, he was a feminist before the word existed, but you know, he was the one that appointed the first female imam. You know, a woman leading men and women in prayer. Somehow, that's taboo. And so, you know, once I've uncovered a lot of this good stuff, it's really impossible to sort of ignore it. It's impossible to set it aside and think, well, that's just, you know, that's to still cling on to the traditional and orthodoxy when the evidence is otherwise, right? And so he was also the first one that appointed, you know, the first teachers, the first one to run his education ministry, so to speak. So he really empowered women to a great degree, which sadly in our majority of the Muslim countries, that's not the case. Women are really sidelined and treated as second-class citizen in the name of religion.
So, Ani, what does literalist or conservative Islam look like?
Well, I am considered not Muslim enough. I don't wear a headscarf. The fact that I'm accepting of all religions or non-faith traditions as equal to my belief system. So there's just very huge gaps between what they believe and what I believe and Muslims in the progressive communities believe in general. I mean, we believe in total egalitarian values. That means there's no hierarchy of who's, you know, who's more religiously authorized, which is, you know, what the Quran also teaches. It's a flat hierarchy. And so if there's such a flat hierarchy in the Quran, why do we have such a male-dominated hierarchy in the way Islam is being practiced right now, right? So a lot of the things that Islam is being practiced right now actually contradicts the Quran.
Speak to some of those specifically, because we all see these expressions of literalist or fundamentalist Islam, because they're the ones that get the headlines. They're the ones that people point at and say, see, it's evil. See, they're the enemy. They're the people you shouldn't, for example, let into your country. We saw this in the Trump era. He banned Muslims from entering the US from a number of countries. What is it about that expression?
So there's a lot. I think probably the most dominant one that has, well, the narrative that has dominated the Christian right in how they've used this passage to demonize Islam. I'll give you two. One is the wife beating, the infamous wife beating verse in the Quran, which is chapter 4, verse 24, I think it is. And the way the traditionalists have interpreted it is that the husband has the right to beat the wife if she disobeys him. Now, in reality, now that word, daraba, in Arabic has 17 different meanings because, you know, there's that, you know, if you put a line above an alphabet in Arabic, it becomes an A. If you put it below, it becomes an E. And if it's an, so when the Quran was written, it didn't have the vowels, right? It didn't have the vowel markers. And so people started putting vowel markers in it. And so that word now has, could mean 17 different meanings. And one of the other meaning, instead of beads, is to actually to walk away, which in reality is how Prophet Muhammad behave when he had an argument with his wife at one time, and he did a timeout. It's like, okay, I'm gonna just separate from you for a month. And so he separated from his wife. And so it's easy for me to challenge a lot of these conservative Muslims who have been preaching that this verse is about wife beating. And it's so easy. It's like, okay, you've got the beard, the same length as Prophet Muhammad, you're wearing the robe, the way he dressed, etc. But your preaching is contradictory to his behavior. And so they can't really counter that argument. Because the evidence, and they know the history, right? So they're just being hypocritical. So that's one example. The other example that a lot of the Christian and the Jewish pro-Israeli right like to use in order to slam Islam and Muslims is the passage about, and spite them, meaning the Christians and Jews, wherever you find them, right? That means kill them, right? In the verse. But this was in a particular context of a war where Prophet Muhammad was the governor of a secular state, mind you, where he was governing several different tribes, including Christians and Jews and pagans and Muslims. And the covenant that they had among themselves was that they would all defend each other. And what happened was one of the Jewish tribes betrayed the covenant and allowed for the Meccans to come in. And, you know, there was this whole war because they've been trying to kill Prophet Muhammad, right? And so that was the passage of a particular historical event of a particular time. Now, the first martyr in that, in the Medina governorship was a rabbi. Muslims don't know that. Jews don't know that. But everybody knows that this Quran passage talks about killing in Jews, right? And then I'll give you another example of how, and the Orthodox Muslims and radical Muslims will use the same, will use that verse to justify their hate for the other. And that's the point where the Christian right and the Jewish right pick up, because they're picking up from the radical Muslims. Right? So that's why it's important for us as Muslims to clean up our act, to really counter that radical interpretation from within us so that non-Muslims can't use it against us, because it is off base. It is a bastardization of the Quran. And another example is that Prophet Muhammad had covenants with Christian tribes and Jewish tribes. And it basically states that we will protect you and your places of worship until the end of time. That is such a problem. And that is evidence, right? But we are not taught that either. So there's some really good stuff that I've uncovered, you know, as I started relearning Islam, because I was, after 9/11, I was questioning my faith too. Like, what the hell is this? You know, jihad, killing innocent people? This is crazy. You know, I mean, and I've never heard of this term jihad in the way it was used. And I'm born, raised Muslim. And so in relearning the religion for myself, for, you know, independent of any institution, there was a lot of good stuff that I found. And that's why I'm still a Muslim. And the one verse that has, you know, really instilled my progressive values is the verse about justice, and that you have to speak up for justice, even if it is against your own self-interest. And I think that's a powerful verse, guideline, moral compass. Right? You don't have to be Muslim to believe that, right?
Ani, I hear you talking about going back to the Quran and going back to the history as if this is a source. And I guess it is, right? Of course, it's a source for Islam. But my question to you on the back of all that is, how literally do you personally take the Quran and Islam's historical claims?
With a grain of salt, because not everything in the Quran is, I think, something that I would follow. Like I said, you can cherry pick. However, given the historical context of doing my own independent readings, I also know that after Prophet Muhammad died, there was a lot of violence because then it became a political Islam. I mean, literally after they buried him, it became a political Islam. It became who was going to be the caliphate, who's going to be the leader of the Muslim world, right? And so that's where they lost me, right there. But I can stick with the spiritual stuff. And when it comes to the spiritual stuff that is ritualistic, I'm not really, I don't feel attached to it like I used to growing up or in my younger days. I find the spirituality of Islam really meshed with the spirituality of some practices of Christianity, of Native American practices, especially Native American practices. And for me, like connecting with Mother Earth and connecting with nature is where my spirituality resides. And there's a lot of that also in the stories and in the Quran, but unfortunately that's not what's being highlighted in the traditional teachings of Islam. Yeah.
There's just so many parallels with Christianity and definitely what we came across over our years with a lot of people wanting to get back to Jesus, get back to the real Jesus before it became politicized, before it became part of the patriarchal system, all of that. So it's really interesting. And this is exactly why we want to interview people like yourself, to show people that there's so many synergies between many of the religions. Yeah.
And the thing about it is that because of the work that I do, where I'm challenging the orthodoxy and the status quo and the patriarchy and the sexism, when that all that stuff is being justified in the name of Islam, I have to use Islam in order to counter it. If I'm going to use secular language, it doesn't work, right? It falls on deaf ears. It's like you're talking secular terms. We don't care about secular values. So I have to talk to them in the language that means something to them. And for them, it's the language of Islam. And so that's why I'm well-versed in a lot of these passages, because that's what I've been using in countering a lot of the human rights abuses in the name of religion and in the name of Islam.
So Ani, how do you define progressive Islam then, or progressive values within Islam?
Yeah, it's very simple. It's basically the love and compassionate for all and for all of God's creation, and caring for the environment. And it's being mindful of our brothers and sisters. What is really difficult is actually compassion, and particularly compassion for those who are not part of your tribe. And particularly now in this conflict that we're seeing to Israel and Gaza, you know, the conflict there, you know, the compassion for the other side or the Israeli victims. And it's really hard, whoever you define the other is, to have compassion for them. And I think that is the truest sense of spirituality, or walking in the steps of, you know, being, sorry to say, but being godly, quote unquote godly. But I think that's it's a tall order for us human beings to be compassionate.
Yeah, I think it is. I agree. I think it's one of the hardest things to see the other and to see yourself in the other, despite your, you know, the vast chasms of difference between so many people.
Yeah.
We're also interested in, you spoke before about 12-year-old Arnie being admonished by her mum for the call to prayer, and we've heard where you are now. What are some of the things in between? How did you get to where you are today with that epiphany that you had essentially as a 12-year-old? What are some of those key things? And tell us about your life, your journey through, and some of those things, how they changed and landed you where you've landed now.
My upbringing was very interesting. My parents, you know, as ambassador's daughter, you're very privileged. But my parents made sure in that privilege, I understood my responsibilities as well. And so they would take us to what they call educational trips, right? So when we lived in Cairo, it was at the tail end of the Arab Six-Day War with Israel. And my dad reached out to the Egyptian military and said, hey, we want to come and visit Port Said City. Port Said City was completely bombed out during the war. So they, you know, so with the military escort, we went to Port Said City. And there you see, you know, broken down tanks and you see, you know, apartment buildings bombed out and personal belongings just, you know, hanging and visible to the naked eye. So that was my experience as a 10-year-old girl. And that's just one example of really looking at things from a different perspective outside of your own privileged prism. And so all these different corner, you know, meeting dignitaries that we had receptions at our home. And, you know, I would meet the Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, President Morarji Desai. We had Mrs. Sadat over for dinner. It, you know, it was these kind of exposures that really highlight the privilege, but at the same time, they made sure that I understood the culture, the context, the politics. Oh my God, politics is huge in my family. And I was always curious about foreign policy. And at the young age of 11 or 12, I was already reading a magazine called the Far Eastern Economic Review, which doesn't exist anymore, but it's a really heavy duty policy magazine. So with the magazine on one hand and a dictionary on the other, because, you know, I couldn't understand a lot of the vocab. But that's kind of like how that was how I was at a young age, and graduating in economics and political science, and I told my dad, okay, I'm done. I kept my promise, and I want to do what I want to do, and that was music. And so then I moved to Los Angeles to pursue a career in music, and that I think was a time when I was really out of my comfort, out of my element. The music business is such a doggy dog world. There's no etiquette. You know, it's just a completely different way of living than as a diplomat, as you can imagine. And but you know, and I was a closeted Muslim when I was in the music business. And then 9/11 happened, and you know, I just had that fork in the road, and I decided that, you know what, I need to do something more meaningful than write silly pop songs. And so here I am.
Hey, Bonnie.
Hey, Karen.
Do you remember what you were afraid of back in 2018 when we started our comedy podcast, Deconversion Therapy?
Yes, we were afraid people would think that we're a therapy podcast. But now they know better after listening to us talk about purity culture, scandals at Bethel Church, Hillsong, and how some comedy icons like George Carlin talk about religion.
Don't forget the cults. Plus, we do lettersodes when we read listeners' stories about their cringy experiences.
And there's a lot of cringe, and our listeners are the best. They have created an amazing community of support.
Mm-hmm. But in 2018, you were afraid we wouldn't have enough material. 5 years later, nearly 250 episodes, and we're still finding new stupid shit about people abusing power in the name of religion.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like 250 episodes, but maybe that's because we have been at this friendship thing since we were age one.
Years of evangelical Sunday school, church, school, youth group, mission trips, and college.
Years of repression and being good, obedient girls.
And then we became worldly.
And then we became worldly.
So join our community. Listen to Deconversion Therapy Podcasts in all the listening places.
So why were you a closeted Muslim when you're in the music industry? What was it that you saw the cost would be of being an out there Muslim?
You know, I was already a minority of a minority, and it was just already difficult as it was. It was at a time when there was internet didn't exist. So the communication was very challenging, was very difficult. Everything was analog, phone calls. It was meeting people. You had to send your music, your demonstration or your demos, right? Your song demos by mail. Two publishers, and it was just being, you know, having the name Zuriani already, that is my full name, is already foreign, and I just felt that it, you know, just adding another element of, you know, what religion or what faith tradition you come from was just not necessary. And also there's a lot of sexism in the music industry. And when I started out, I was doing production and arrangement, and, you know, I was doing the programming music. And so I wasn't doing what women were expected to do, and that was write lyrics and sing. I was doing what men were doing. And so that was already a challenge to overcome. There's stories behind that too, but, and it was such a cliquish industry. This is not so much anymore, but you had the black charts, you had the rock charts, which is mostly white folks, and you had the black charts, that was mostly the black folks. Doesn't matter if you did R&B, you know, what color skin you were, but because you were black, you were automatically in the R&B charts. And so it was really segregated by race in addition to that. And everybody was cliquish. I know I'm Asian, but I'm not the East Asian, right? The Korean, the Chinese, Japanese type, for, you know, or so. You had the black groups, you know, the black folks hanging out with the black folks, and you had the white folks, and you had the Jewish groups, and you got Latino groups, you know. And I didn't fit in into any of that, so it was hard enough as it is.
Fair enough. Remove the barriers that you have control over.
Yeah. Ani, I'm really interested in the sort of spiritual evolution. Can you tell us about what it's like? Do Muslims experience God, or are there different branches within Islam that experience God and some that are more sort of cerebral? I mean, that's what we see in Christianity. You've got some expressions of Christianity which almost deny the supernatural while still believing in God, of course. And then you've got others that try to experience God on a daily basis and feel God and believe that he's performing miracles, etc. What did you sort of grow up with, and what evolved in that space for you? And do you see yourself more as a rationalist, or do you try to experience God? What does that all look like? I mean, that's a huge question, I know, but I'd really like to hear.
Yeah. I am a rationalist, but I'm also spiritual at the same time. So the work that I do is very fulfilling, and it fulfills my purpose in life. And I'm blessed to have a purpose in life. And I have to thank my dad for really challenging me growing up. Ani, whatever you do in life, make your life count. Right? That was sort of hammered into my head. And so that fork in the road that I spoke of was that moment where I just felt that, you know, there's really something more meaningful in life. And I came to that, that thought crossed my mind because I worked so hard to to work myself into the industry because I didn't know anyone. And then, you know, I achieved getting this Grammy certification and I didn't feel anything. Now, when you work so hard for something and you are rewarded for it, you should be elated, right? But I felt nothing. And so, and that was that point where I just sat back and I just sort of stepped out of my own body and just like, okay, what is, why am I not elated? And I just sort of analyzed that. And I just basically came to the conclusion there's got to be something more meaningful in my life than just doing this music or this kind of music. And but the one thing that really was the impetus for me to start Muslims for Progressive Values and the work that I'm doing now in defending human rights, defending people's right to leave Islam, defending people's right to just express themselves freely, because that is their right according to the Quran. Now, a lot of Muslim countries will use the Quran to deny people the right to think and express freely or to leave religion. And that is a complete, it's the opposite of what the Quran is actually teaching. And so, but what happened was when 9/11 happened, I decided, well, you know what? There's this all these alpha males just talking about Islam, bashing Islam, the politics, the religious leaders that are representing us Muslims in America. Who are these people? They don't represent my values. And so what I decided to do was to do an Islamic pop CD. And I talked about women's rights in Islam. I talked about the role of Prophet Muhammad's wife, who was the financier. I just wrote a lot of stuff that really contradicted and was a counter narrative to what was out there, the radicalism, the terrorism, the talk of war. And I was coming at it from, you know, peaceful coexistence and spirituality and feminism, etc. And so my production was full on pop production, because that's what I did for a living. And I used the guitar, I used different percussions and instruments and programmed and drums, blah, blah, blah. And lo and behold, I didn't realize I was wading into this ridiculous interpretation of Islam that music, number one, is forbidden. And number two, because I was a female singer, my female singing voice was also forbidden. It's sexual. And at that point, when I learned about it, when none of the Muslim retail stores would sell the CD because of these reasons, that's when I said, okay, screw you, I'm out. So, and for many reasons, because number one, music is not forbidden. And number two, I'm born, raised Muslim, and I know the history of Islam better than what they're constructing, you know, this false narrative. And I didn't want to have anything to do with it. And so that's why I started Muslims for Progressive Values. And it was also a challenge to the authorities, religious authorities here, that I will not let you get away with discrimination, no matter who that is. And so that's sort of like the fire in my belly.
I mean, that would definitely be a challenge if I interpreted that through the Christian lens. People definitely, we see pushback of, and people are seen as flaky or not in representing the real Jesus or whatever. How do you get pushback and your organization get pushback for such progressive values from the more literalist, fundamentalist expressions of Islam?
Well, in the US, we used to get a lot of pushback, you know, death threats, the whole nine yards. And some of the religious leaders would actually preach and tell their congregation to harass us by email and by phone calls and things like that. And but that has stopped because what has happened is that the good thing about American Muslims is that a lot of them are educated, right? And so they can read the Quran for themselves. They can read whatever books because we have freedom of information here, unlike Muslim majority countries where a lot of books are banned. You know, if it contradicts the state definition of religion, then it is banned. And so that's the difference in the Western states or here or Europe or Canada. You have complete freedom of information to read whatever you want to read. And so In the beginning, it was very hard. But the media also played a role in pitching us against the traditionalists. So, for example, on LGBTQ rights, they would interview me and my position on LGBTQ rights, and then they would interview the traditional imam. And their response would be so homophobic, it was embarrassing. And so then after reading themselves and what they say and how they've been quoted, you know, they said, oh, shoot, we should really pretend to be progressive. You know, we should pretend to be inclusive. And so, you know, so they got smart and they started talking the language of progressive or the left, political left narrative. And particularly during Trump's time, when Trump was banning Muslim and he was just awful, not just to Muslims, but to Mexicans, to immigrants, he was just awful human being. And so the conservative Muslims, like, holy shit, we're in trouble here. And so they started camouflaging as if they were progressives and speaking of, oh, we are for women's rights and we're for LGBTQ rights, you know, all this utter nonsense, utter lies. And of course, I could see through that. And now I laugh about it because, you know, but what happened then is then Biden won, and then they started coming out of their closet and shedding their farcity and started really revealing, they're still the homophobes and they're still the sexist people that they are and so on and so forth. So, so it's gone through several cycles, but the kicker is that there was an article in the New York Times, an op-ed by a traditional Muslim scholar of Islam of Turkish heritage. And he, in a not so kind of a way, but still I'll take it, he basically said that traditional imams and religious leaders in America are so fearful of Muslims for progressive values because of the cultural impact they have on the next generation of Muslims. And that shift of culture is irreversible. And so I was like, yes. And it's also backed up by statistics with Pew, Pew, which is a reputable and independent research institution. They did a study of attitudes of American Muslims over a span of 10 years. And it's been documented. They have, you know, American Muslims are definitely progressive in their spiritual practice and their belief system.
Ani, I want to tell you a story that I have told on the podcast before. The term that we use is backslidden Christian, right? So I'm still trying to be a Christian, but I'm not really a very good one. And I was living in Singapore and I was at a party.
Well, hang on a second. Wait. I'm going to stop you there. Why do you say you're not a good one?
Oh, at that point in my life, that's basically how you define from a fundamentalist perspective, you're not a very good Christian. And I wasn't holding... I was still holding a lot of those beliefs. And so I was actually under a lot of sort of self-condemnation that I was not walking away yet, but I was still believing it sort of, you know, somewhere within me. And so I was conflicted a lot, you know, in terms of what I was doing and what I was claiming to believe. But I was at a party one night and I met this Malay Muslim young woman who said to me something really interesting. She said, I don't, because we started talking and she explained that she was from quite a strict Muslim household. And she said to me, I still believe in Allah, the Quran, and Muhammad, but I don't go to mosque. And it was really interesting for me because that really aligned with something that I had said before to other people, which was, I still believe in Jesus. I still believe in God. I still believe in the Bible, but I don't go to church. Yeah. And to me, there was a real profound moment of, she's saying exactly the same thing I did, but the names are different. Yep. I later walked away though. I later walked away from my Christianity. You stayed a Muslim. But surely you have friends and family that have walked away totally. What does that look like? And is there a process that you've seen people go through? Do they become quite aggressively anti-Islam, but then maybe later swing back to a more tolerance? What does that sort of look like?
Yeah. Well, 70% of American Muslims don't go to the mosque, and they find spiritual inspiration outside the mosque. And so they identify as Muslim, but they find spiritual inspiration outside. And they also, as the same group of people that believe, like, there are different paths to God. So, you know, the conservative or radical approach is that, no, we are the only, Islam is the only way. And even then, a particular way, a particular type of Muslim, right? Like, I would not qualify. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure I've been condemned to hell by many people, by many Muslims. But what I've seen with Muslims for Progressive Values is that people have their spiritual evolution really varies. So some started from being really radical Muslims to imploding and becoming atheists, and being an atheist for some years, and then in maturity circling back to, like, let me give it another look. Let me read different books. Let me see what else is there. Some go to Hinduism, some go to Christianity, some go to whatever, all sorts of religions. And then they cycle back, and then they come back to Islam. And a lot of times they come back to Islam because of what they read on our website, because of the inclusivity, the egalitarian values, the social justice. You know, it's a religion that speaks to your values. It's not supposed to be a religion that is all about ritual, right? Ritual is supposed to help you get to a spiritual connection to the loving and compassionate human being that you should be. But it's not just empty ritual, which is what it has become. I've also seen ex-Muslims that are very hateful. And as a matter of fact, there's a Reddit, you know, subgroup that all they do is just slam Islam. And they put a lot of resource into slamming Islam. But as unfortunate is that the kind of Islam they're slamming are the very Islam, and that they're validating as the real Islam, and that's why we quit Islam, is the very Islam that we are countering as being, it's not the real thing. And so ex-Muslims have become, have not become our ally. They've become actually part of the radical Muslim side, because they subscribe to the same ideology, except one believes and one doesn't, right? And I understand the trauma they've gone through, and a lot of them have gone through a lot of trauma. I get that. But I'm here defending their right, and as a Muslim, and challenging their governments, putting my life at risk defending their rights. And so... But, you know, I'm not asking for gratitude or, you know, but the minimum, don't hate me for being a Muslim, right? So I've seen that. My family is not progressive anymore, you know, because of the influence of Wahhabism in the world and the competition between Iran and Saudi Arabia. You know, they both at one point, you know, the 80s especially, were competing how more restrictive and more crazy one can be in the name of religion. And so now the Saudi Arabia of the last 2 years is different, because all of a sudden, oh, you know, women don't have to wear hijab. Oh no, we don't need moral police. Oh no, we, you know, they're just like turn 180 degrees. And so, but the damage has been done. And so the Wahhabism that has influenced the Muslim world is so entrenched, and it has impacted, you know, members of my family, and the folks in Malaysia, for the majority part, they are very, very conservative and very Wahhabi in their, you know, like your Singaporean friend, acquaintance there, raised a very restricting, you know, religious home. And that's the hardest challenge for me, is to have my family members who are just on the other end of the scale.
It's interesting seeing the parallel of the angry atheists who attack a certain form of Islam. We see very much the same thing in the ex-Christian scene here, that they attack the fundamentalist form, but they don't allow a more moderate Christianity to exist. They think that that's just as bad, or that's giving air to, you know, and it's, I just, sorry to state the obvious, but the parallel is just blatant that it's exactly the same kind of thing. Yeah.
You've spoken a bit about what your organization, Muslims for Progressive Values, do. Can you tell us a bit more about the organization? You've spoken about definitely the rights of women and the LGBTQI community, but how did it start? What were the roots of it, and what is the vision, and what do you do as part of your core work?
Yeah. So after 9/11, people were really grappling with what it meant to be a Muslim, and if so, what kind of Muslim? When I started the Progressive Muslim Community in Los Angeles, I started discovering there were other Muslim folks like myself in other different chapters and different cities. And we kind of got to know each other through meetup.com, through Yahoo groups. And so in 2007, we convened the founding conference of Muslims for Progressive Values at Sarah Lawrence College in New York. And the founding board members voted me as the executive director or president, and tasked with go ahead and, you know, get this organization registered. And but they also know that, you know, I'm a doer. So if I say I'm going to do something, or if, you know, I commit, then I really commit. So as a result, I've been running it ever since. And the work that we do is really using Islam in the positive light, and that is to really challenge patriarchy, sexism, racism. You know, we in the United States, for example, we are the ones that we are the go-to Muslim organization when it comes to filing amicus briefs in support of reproductive rights or against discrimination of LGBT people, for example. At the moment, in the last, you know, 10 years or so, I've also been developing a catalog of songs that are uniquely from Western Muslims. And so, because most of us, other than the African-American Muslims, most of us are immigrants from somewhere else, and our Islam or cultural practice is based from wherever we came from. And so it's in a different language, right? It could be in Urdu, Arabic, Turkish, what have you. And so as American Muslims, we don't have an American Muslim cultural identity. And so what makes MPV different is that we've created a new culture. And so, but the new culture is really rooted in the teachings of the Quran of egalitarianism. So for example, when I lead prayer and I do the Kofar prayer and I lead prayer, I lead men and women in prayer. Trans people can choose to stand where they want, whatever they feel comfortable. And families can pray together, right? You can't do that in the mosque. And if you're not comfortable, men one side, women one side. Right. And so we take turns. So another time, you know, a man will lead prayer and I'll do the call for prayer. We really want the members of the community to take spiritual leadership, which is often denied because of that hierarchy and patriarchy. And so that's like, that's a spiritual space. And the songs that I've created are spiritual songs that are like, for example, Prophet Muhammad's favorite prayer, but it's the lyrics is set to classical music. And I love church choirs. And so I've arranged the vocals in huge choral arrangements and, you know, strings and so on and so forth. And so I've used my music to create an American Muslim culture, which is, you know, really necessary if we are going to be part of that society. And this applies to Muslims in the West, whether it be Australia, New Zealand, Europe, Canada. So that's one, that's that spiritual culture. And then there's also the secular culture too. So a lot of Muslims are marrying outside the faith, and their partners are not converting to Islam. So who's going to marry them? And so we do that service too. We provide marriage services for Muslims who are marrying outside the faith. Actually, you know, we marry folks from all over the world, not just in the United States, and no conversion, right? And then, so where do their children go? Where do their non-Muslim families and friends go to partake in a tradition that is meaningful for you as an American Muslim, a progressive American Muslim? So we're creating a musical theater production that can be used as a celebration of, for example, the end of Ramadan. Right now, we don't have anything. We just go to the mosque and then we eat. That's it. We don't have anything that is a cultural expression that is celebrative, that can unify people, whether you're Muslim or not. And so that's like really getting into the weeds. And then I do a lot of advocacy work at the United Nations as well. So we're a member of the, you know, Multi-Faith Advisory Council for the UN, all the 27 agencies. And I also, you know, work with religious leaders in Africa and getting them to preach and teach about women and girls' rights in their societies. And yeah, so it's a three different buckets there for me.
You're doing a lot of work there. And I know you've hinted at this and you've even said it outright, but I do want to ask you again, do the more traditional Muslims and conservative Muslims, are they forced to accept you, or do they still just say, they're not real Muslims?
No, they are. They've acknowledged I work with conservative Muslims, like the imams in Africa that I work with. We have a network of 3,400 imams now. They're traditional. They're conservative. They won't support LGBTQ rights, but that's okay. They are all for promoting women and girls' rights, empowering women's right to economic independence, and so on and so forth. So when your religious leaders are teaching and preaching egalitarian values for women and girls, the society changes as well. And as a result of that, we also support women, you know, with their economic development funding, seed funding, them to start businesses. And so they flourished. And when they flourished, they also become active in politics as well. So, you know, so, and that is simply rooted in the religious leader doing what they're responsible to do, and that is to promote, you know, human rights for everyone. And so a lot of times, you know, there's a lot of money that goes into education, particularly in Africa and Muslim societies, from these secular foundations. And they put so much money in it, but they're too afraid to touch the framework of religion. And you can build the infrastructure, all the schools you want, but if the imam tells the family and society, girls cannot go to school or should not go to school, they should just be married off as soon as they get their period, those schools are not going to get filled. And so you have to change the society's mindset in order to fill the schools. And that's what I do.
You said there they don't necessarily advocate for LGBTQI, and that's okay. I'm guessing what you mean by that, and correct me if I'm wrong, is one step at a time, pick your battles.
Yeah. And also you can get killed. Yeah. Not just me, but them. And, you know, as a matter of fact, one of my partners almost did die because he said there's no punishment for being homosexual in the Quran. And he almost died, and I had to rescue him. So it's not, even when we're talking about women and girls' rights, there's a lot of threats against the imams in our network because they're really challenging the radical imams, and the radical imams don't want to see women and girls flourish. They don't want to see the other faith traditions as equals. They want to divide and conquer. You know, that's their mindset. And they're being funded by the Gulf states, some of the rich states. And we're up against that.
Well, there's a lot at stake. They are definitely going to lose a lot by letting half the population have a power that they don't have under the current system. So,
well, that's why, you know, if you look at the stats, a lot of the Muslim world, they're behind because the women are and girls are behind. You know, it's evident. Yeah.
So, Arnie, if you had the opportunity to speak to progressive Christians, of which we have a lot in our audience, and also speaking to those ex-Christians, what sort of corrective statements would you like to make about some of the attitudes towards Islam, towards progressive Islam?
I would say first and foremost is that we all, you know, we all pray to the same God. And the history of our faith traditions are so intertwined. And that would be number one. You know, sorry to the two of you, but we have a chapter in the Quran called Mary, okay? Most Christians don't know that. So, we can start from there.
Yeah, please tell us about it. We know nothing about this.
Okay, so the story of Mary giving birth to Jesus, there are some similarities, but there's also some differences as well. And it really speaks about the anguish that Mary went through, her pregnancy, and how she basically talks to God, like, how can I be pregnant, and so on and so forth. There is a... you know, it's a very important, I mean, that's why a lot of Muslim women are called Maryam, which is the Arabic name for Mary. So that's, you know, when you hear Maryam, then you know where that's coming from. And the story about Jesus as being the difference, I should say, about Jesus from the Islamic perspective is that he did not die at the crucifix. But how he died or where did he go and all that is a mystery. It's not clear in the Quran. And so the story from the difference between Christianity and Islam, and this is the huge difference, is that in Islam you're born pure, free of sin. Whereas in Christianity, you're born with sin and Jesus, and you have to embrace Jesus to be... what's the word?
Saved.
to be saved. That's right. So that's those two concepts are very different. And there's a few other differences, and that is, for example, in Christianity, Eve was created from the rib of Adam. That's not in Islam. It doesn't say who was created first. It was intentionally vague, and it stated that one was created to be partners of the other. Now, funny enough, the Orthodox and traditional Muslims have bought into the Christian narrative of who came first and that Eve was created from the rib of Adam. I'm like, wait a minute, that's not Islam, that's Christianity. What happened? So it's interesting how Muslims, conservative Muslims, are actually borrowing from the patriarchy version of Christianity. It's very interesting.
Cherry picking is alive and well, Arnie. I mean, anything that can support your argument and your stance is definitely something that I think a lot of religions do, and certainly a lot of, particularly the more.
And the funny thing is that they're the same people who hate on the other.
Yeah, that's right. They've got that in common. Imagine if they came together. God, that'd be scary.
Oh, that would be so wonderful. And go off on an island and leave the rest of us alone, please.
That sounds like a great idea. I love your work. So if someone were out there listening to this, how do they get in contact with you at MPV? But also, what sort of things do you offer? What are some of the things that you can do for people that want to connect in with you?
The best thing for you to do is to sign up to a monthly newsletter, and that kind of updates you on all that is going on, what we do, what we're thinking, or what I'm thinking and what I'm writing about and what's been occupying my mind. It also highlights the different chapters in the United States that are having activities. As far as policy goes, you know, I will highlight the various policies that we've been involved in or court cases that we've been involved in. As far as services, we've, you know, if you go to our Instagram page, it's full of content. It's full of the progressive theology in a very simple way. One thing that we are really good at is taking the progressive philosophers of Islam and theologians and take it out of the academia world and really simplified it to an English language that is, you know, for a 12-year-old to a 14-year-old reader. That way, if you're a non-English reader, you could still understand it, right? So that's the sort of thing that we've been doing. That's one of the reasons why the majority of American Muslims have become progressive as a result of the content that we've been putting up, the public educational content that we put out. Right now, we also have a program called the Purple Checkmark, and what we've been doing is basically vetting mental health counselors who are LGBT affirming, because there are also Muslim mental health counselors in the United States who subscribe to, you know, conversion therapy, which is illegal, but still. So we vet them, and then when approved, they get this purple check mark with MPV on it, and so they can put that on a website and what have you, and the card, and that way LGBT Muslims will know that if I come to MPV's website and I see these list of purple check mark approved mental health professionals, I'm going to be safe going to them. So that's kind of some of the things that we've done as well. The marriage services, like I said, you know, we conduct interfaith with no conversion as well as same-sex marriages. yeah.
You really are progressive, Arnie. Frighteningly progressive. I can
that pause, Brian, was gold.
Because I mean, again, it's just parallels with a progressive Christianity. It's exactly the same stuff that we see: is people being affirming, people trying to progress social views and push up against the system. So the pause was from me was just like, this is the same. Like it's the same push. You guys need to get together with the progressive Christians. We're speaking to a progressive Christian as well, as we said at the start. So we're going to join you up.
Yeah. No, actually, we do a lot of work with progressive Christians and progressive Jews and Hindus and Sikhs and so on, because we do find that our values, you know, really sync up beautifully. And so a lot of times our allies are you know, progressive faith organizations. And so in respect to, you know, faith and values, you know, one of my favorite church is the All Saints Church in Pasadena. And that's, you know, quote unquote, that's kind of like my church, because, you know, they have been instrumental in raising the issue of apartheid of South Africa when it was, and it was also against the wishes of the American government, who was for apartheid. So this is a church that really stood by its values. And I have tremendous respect for that. And so, yeah. So come Christmas, I'm always invited to sit at the front, right at the front of the pew, and actually participate by reading a passage of the Quran about Mary, for example. So I've done a lot of, you know, work and talking and participation and partnership with progressive institutions.
Arnie, I've got to say that this has been a really wonderful hour sitting with you, hearing about what you're doing. I feel a real warmth towards you and what you're trying to do and what you are doing. And so I want to congratulate you on what you're doing, but I also want to say, you know, kudos to you. It's absolutely wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you, Troy.
Yeah, I want to thank you as well. It's been enlightening. I mean, this isn't something that we ever spent time with, obviously, as Christians. We spent time praying for you, let me say. Because
and sometimes against you. Sometimes against you.
Yes, that's right. But we would never sit and talk with. I mean, obviously, since I left Christianity, I've definitely connected with a lot of Muslim people of different expressions of Islam. And again, you today are another expression. So it is fantastic to hear that, and fantastic to hear the similarities, and slightly scary, but also I think just really encouraging that there's people out there like you and organisations such as MPV trying to carve a way forward that is more positive, that is more influential to people's rights and definitely people's ability to thrive in the world. So thank you so much for what you do and what MPV does.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, guys.
No worries. If you'd like to connect with the I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist podcast, then please see the links in our link tree in the show notes. We invite you to join our listener community on Facebook, and we're also on Instagram, X, and Reddit. Check out our merch on Redbubble. We've got t-shirts, hoodies, mugs, and all kinds of great ex-evangelical stuff that you can wear proudly. All proceeds go to building and promoting the podcast. We want to give a huge shout out to our Patreon supporters. Subscribers get a range of benefits, including free merch, early access to episodes, access to our exclusive subscribers group, and monthly bonus content. Again, all proceeds of this go to the running and promotion costs of the podcast. A special thanks to Ava, who manages our social strategy, and also to Kerry and Bree, who manage our Facebook listener group, and also to Bree, who puts out our monthly newsletter on Substack. All of our episodes are transcribed by Leanne to increase accessibility. The show is produced and hosted by Brian McDowell and Troy Waller. The sound engineering for this episode was done by Clifford. I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist is available wherever you find your podcasts. Again, you can find all our links in our link tree in the show notes. Or why don't you pop across to our website at www.iwasateenagefundamentalist.com.